This is an ABC podcast.
No ia e Māori, Nissan Bolivinaka, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. We'd like to acknowledge that our show comes to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. A lot happening in the Pacific. Well, first was the apology, but now there's resignations within Tonga's government. Organised crime is increasing in the Pacific, and Fiji and Drua make history in their most recent win over the Waratahs. More on those stories shortly. Remember, once our show is done, all our stories will be up online for you to replay if you've missed anything today. Simply type Pacific Beat Radio Australia into your search engine. Let's get on with the show. I'm Aggie Dubow and this is Pacific Beat. Well, some breaking news. Tonga's Prime Minister resigns from defence portfolio and Foreign Minister steps down. This week, the eyes of the Tongan public will turn to the remote island of Vava'u in the country's north. King Tupou VI will meet with advisers, the Privy Council, after receiving an apology from the Prime Minister, Siausi Sovaleni. And while it appears to have diffused the tensions, it's remained unclear what agreement his government has reached with the king. The ABC's Tonga reporter, Marion Kupu, has the story.
The remote island of Vava'u is widely known for its whales, white sandy beaches and turquoise waters. But this week, the tourist hotspot will be the venue for a meeting that could determine the future for Tonga's government. King Tupou VI's meeting with Privy Councillors in Vava'u, the first since the Prime Minister Sovaleni and his ministers made a traditional apology known as Hulo Wifi after they defied the king's wishes.
It has not been an easy relationship, to say the least.
Pacific politic expert Malakai Kolamatangi says mending the bridge will not be straightforward, with the falling out reflecting an ongoing unease between Tonga's monarchy and government.
So the tension between that and the actual political process and government process has not been easy to resolve.
The traditional apology follows political tension that erupted last month when the Privy Council wrote a letter to the Prime Minister saying the King was withdrawing his confidence and consent in him as Defence Minister and calling for the removal of Foreign Minister. Despite the apology and this week's meeting, it remains unclear what will happen next for Tonga's government.
Particularly when you consider that the monarch holds preeminence in the political system on two platforms. One, as the constitutional monarch, but secondly, also as the head of state with his cultural powers, right? As the father figure, if you like, for the nation.
Before 2010, the monarch was both head of government and head of state. That changed in Tonga, with reforms allowing democratically elected MPs and giving them power to choose the Prime Minister. But the King holds on to some powers. He can dissolve the Parliament, heads the armed forces, and retain a role in Tonga's foreign affairs. At the height of the recent tensions, some expressed concerns that the King's actions threaten to unwind democratic reforms. But opposition MP Martin Tapoiluelu says the episode has one silver lining.
People are thinking about the constitution and its true implication. The majority of the people are really just talking about the need to really define the role of the king and the role of cabinet in order to bring about a more stable government.
He's proposed a parliamentary committee to discuss political issues, including form of elections in Tonga. Pacific Security College Deputy Director Henry Uvaraturi says the recent crisis shows King Tupou VI will take an interest in the affairs of state and be willing to express his displeasure.
I think he will continue to play a bigger role in the affairs of the modern state, and I think the process of reforms will have to continue and to really help clarify where the monarch's role is.
The ABC has contacted the Prime Minister and the Privy Council for comment. While the nation awaits the outcome of Thursday's meeting, opinion is still divided on whether the king went too far. But some, like Nuku'alofa resident Ungatea Fonuakata, remain hopeful the nation's democracy will continue to develop. She likens episodes like this to labor pains for Tonga.
These are the things that we will have to go through, because they don't just happen overnight. Changes to political systems and attitudes and beliefs, they will have to go through. I have to go through a process, and I think Tonga is going through that process, whether it is a well-thought-out process is something that is to be questioned.
And that's Nuku'alofa resident Ungatea Fonuakata, ending that story from ABC's reporter in Tonga, Marianne Kupu. As the United Nations International Seabed Authority prepares to begin its second week of meetings in Jamaica, the pressure is building for the ISA Council to impose regulations allowing for the world's oceans to be mined. Among those pushing for the change is Nauru. Other Pacific nations like Fiji are calling for a moratorium on seabed mining. The Metals Company, which has a mining joint venture with Nauru, is calling for environmental group Greenpeace to be stripped of its observer status at the Council, after protesters boarded a deep-sea mining research vessel last year. So joining us this morning from Kingston, Jamaica, is Hawaiian elder Billy Kaha'o Halahala, better known as Uncle Sol, of the Papahanao Mokuakea Marine National Monument Advisory Council and Native Hawaiian Cultural Working Group. With that, I say aloha, Uncle Sol.
Hi, aloha from far away.
Yes, absolutely. But thank you again for joining us this morning. You know, you're with the Greenpeace International Delegation. I'm just wondering, has the International Seabed Authority made its decision on whether it will remove Greenpeace's observer status there from the Council?
On Friday, the discussions came to an end and a conclusion, and there was no decision coming about from the ISA. So we don't expect that that Greenpeace will be sanctioned by any kind of removal at this point. Yeah.
Okay. But if so, is there any expectation as to when that could happen, though?
No, I don't think that any of the members seated here want to intervene in the processes that have already been decided by the legal authorities. While there was discussion and there was, a push by Nauru to try and get the council to make a decision, I think the body is deciding that it should not be involved in that kind of decision as part of the responsibility of the council.
Yeah. I know I'd said it earlier in the introduction there, Uncle Sol, Greenpeace's protest. I understand the boarding of that scientific research vessel was being used as one of those reasons, right, for the organization to be removed. Do you believe that was a good enough reason, though?
No, I think Greenpeace has made a strong case that it was doing what it believed to be its right for freedom of speech and expression, and they presented their case before everyone, and even within, I believe, the Dutch courts about their safety protocols, and that the need for freedom of speech needs to be allowed, whether it's on terrestrial or marine areas, and that is an important kind of thing for us to maintain, so that the people have an opportunity to be able to protest, even as far away as the largest ocean, with no real access by the civil society. So without people like Greenpeace, there would be no way of us knowing what is happening in the great ocean of which we belong to.
So can you just clarify that you are confident that there could be no removal of Greenpeace at this stage?
Yes, I'm confident that they will not be removed. Yeah.
Thank you for that. You know, for Pacific countries like Nauru, we've got Cook Islands and even Tonga, who really support deep sea mining. It is seen as a way to boost their economies and therefore we think about improving lives. Why should they not go ahead and develop themselves?
Well, you know, I come to this body from a perspective that is part of Oceania. I am an indigenous native Hawaiian, and we have a connection based on our genealogy that says that we emerge from the deep sea. And then in the very few lines of our chant and our story or song, it says that we emerge from the deepest depths of the ocean, and that our eldest or the first creature to be created is the ukukoakoa, and for us is the coral polyp. So when you look at the fact that we are tied to these ecosystems, we have an inherent responsibility for the care of these spaces. So for me, it's quite clear as an indigenous Hawaiian that my responsibility is to care for all ecosystems that lead me all the way back to the eldest of our ancestors, which is in the deepest part of the ocean. And therefore, I bear that responsibility. We are ocean people, no different than the Cook Islands and Tonga, who are seeking now at Nauru to make decisions about their own national waters, and in this case, moving across their own authorities into international waters. But I want to appeal to the fact that we are all still ocean people, and we belong to the same ocean of which this activity is being proposed. So I would call upon countries like Nauru, the Cook Islands, and Tonga to be reminded that their decisions are going to have an impact on all of us. And so should they be allowed to make those kinds of decisions that are going to impact not just their countries for potential, what they believe is gains and revenues, at the cost of perhaps destroying what I would say intrusion into the creation of life itself as we speak about it from our own genealogy. And that should they be able to just make decisions with no consideration of their own brothers and sisters of Oceania? So I would like to appeal to them to give that kind of discussion and consideration thought in this body that they sit in. I am not a sitting member of this body, but I am a member of Oceania. And until such time that, you know, the seat for Hawaii is filled in this international body, I can only be thankful that I'm able to express it as an observer in the body that is about to make decisions about the deep sea. So we are one people, we live in one ocean, and we should be able to talk to each other about what that implication means for all of us. You know?
Mahalo for that. If you're just tuning in, you're listening in to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Dubom, speaking with Hawaiian elder and member of the Greenpeace International Delegation, Uncle Sol. Well then, really, is there an alternative to deep sea mining for these small Pacific countries?
Well, you know, we are at a time in this this global earth needing to look at what we're all terming as climate change. And if I look at my own source of creation, so my alternative is part of a saying that we say, ikawa mamua, if you're going to go forward, ikawa mahope, then you must go backward. And by that I mean is that we need to go back to take a look at some of our own beginnings. And if from a Hawaiian traditional cultural perspective, through our chant called the Kumulipo that says that if we keep all things in balance from the creation of the first creatures into the vertical column of the ocean, into the nearshore waters, into the lands, into the hills, and even taking flight into the sky, we the people have an opportunity to help support it because we belong to these ecosystems. And I believe that we are not here, we are not ushered into this space we call Honua, the earth, to have dominion or dominance of all things, that we are part of it. And if we don't see ourselves as part of it, then we will see ourselves as being dominant over all things, and then we can direct and we can do whatever we want. I take a different approach to that. And to me, if we reversed some of those kinds of policies and thinking, what would happen if we gave places like the Pacific, Oceania, a place for creation to continue its processes that deal with carbon sequestration, that produce oxygen, that are part of the food web, that give us an opportunity to live? And would that make a difference moving forward? And I believe that there is that kind of possibility. And perhaps that should be where we might focus our journey forward, rather than looking at it as just commodities and places for extraction. We should look at it for places that need protection to give us all life, not just indigenous people from Oceania, but for the Honua, for the earth itself, you know. So for me, that's a clear responsibility that is difficult in this time, because we're dealing with policies that have already been created, and we have never been a part of those policy creations. So coming in at this point at a body like this seems to be very awkward, because we're coming in when we're expected to fit within the structure of laws that have been made with no inclusion by our indigenous people. And I can speak especially for myself as an indigenous Hawaiian, we have never sat at the table when these policies were being decided upon. And so we come now, you know, and better now than not at all, you know.
Absolutely. Uncle Saul, I want to say mahalo nui loa. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for inviting me.
No worries.
So mahalo to you.
Mahalo. That is Hawaiian elder Uncle Saul Billy Kaho'o Halahala of the Papahanao Mokuakea Marine National Monument Advisory Council and Native Hawaiian Cultural Working Group here on Pacific Beat.
Hi, I'm Seyuli Salamasina von Reiki, and I invite you to come with me to explore how our Pacific cultures have evolved with the changing times in a new show, Culture Compass. You'll meet people who are passionate about keeping traditions alive, passing them down to the next generation while adapting old ways to the present. Culture Compass, Tuesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. The Pacific Islands have traditionally been thought to be largely immune from high levels of criminal activity, but that's not the case anymore, according to the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organised Crime. For the first time, it has launched a series of reports mapping regional trends in organised criminality. It's found that the Chinese government's increased presence and activity in the region has brought with it criminal organisations from China, alongside honest entrepreneurs. And although organised gangs are increasingly active, the head of the initiative's Pacific Program, Virginia Kamoli, says the bulk of the criminal activity is being conducted by businesses with legitimate covers.
Some of the forms of criminality that we have seen that are on increase are benefiting from, you know, the changes brought about by globalization and connectivity. So increased trade in the illicit sense is often accompanied by also illicit trade, because oftentimes it's a similar supply chains that are being used. But what we have noticed, particularly with regards to China's increased engagement in political but also in economic terms, is also the arrival of a greater number of entrepreneurs from China but also from other Asian countries that engage in the Pacific Islands. Many of them are totally illegitimate business actors, and many actually have been living in the island, on the islands for a very long time. Unfortunately, they've also also been accompanied by a different cadre of business actors that are taking advantage of these increased investments and Chinese presence to also engage in illicit activities. And in fact, one of the most interesting findings of our work is that in many cases, the bulk of the organized criminality is not conducted by the more, let's say, traditional criminal actors such as, you know, gangs and cartels, who are also present, of course, but the bulk is actually conducted by business actors, by companies that have they run, you know, regular businesses that have a totally illicit facade, but in addition to that, they also engage in all sorts of criminality.
Can you give me some examples of those kinds of actors?
The extractive sector is particularly vulnerable to those activities. And here I'm talking in particular about logging and mining that in places such as Papua New Guinea and Solomon Islands, those are very resource-rich countries. We see, for instance, that most of the timber that is exported from those countries and is exported by Asian companies is unfortunately exported illegally. And so these, as I said, legitimate companies that engage in this criminality. Unfortunately, in addition to the illicit or illegal logging or mining activities per se, there is also around those sectors additional forms of criminality linked to human trafficking, labor and sexual exploitation of both children and adults, and of course a network of corruption around those.
One thing I've noticed in covering the area for a while now is that it seems to have moved away from being a transshipment point for drug cartels to actually developing domestic markets for drugs. And there's a lot more prevalence of drugs like cocaine, methamphetamines in the region. Did you find that as well?
Absolutely. I think that is one also of the big changes that we are seeing. As you highlighted, for a long time, we've thought of Pacific Islands as simply transshipment points, but we're seeing drugs being produced. For instance, methamphetamine labs have been discovered over the past few years in a number of places, in Fiji, for instance. We've seen an increase in the number of seizures of those drugs as well. And we are seeing a development of local consumption markets, because traditionally there was some consumption of those hard drugs, but it was usually around tourist areas. So the main consumers were actually foreigners. But now we are seeing the development of a domestic market. And this is happening in places where the health services are not particularly strong. So these new trends really put a significant strain, not only on a law enforcement, but also on the public health sector of these countries.
Do law enforcement agencies in the region, you think, have the resources necessary to tackle this increase in activity?
Throughout all the interviews that we've conducted on the ground, I think one of the recurring themes was, especially when talking to local law enforcement, was, you know, we lack resources, sometimes even the most basic resources, for instance, because we are talking about countries that often consists of multiple hundreds of islands. So if an investigation needs to take place in one of the faraway islands, there are very basic issues such as, do we have fuel for the boats to take us there? Do we have, you know, the men to send to investigate? Just to give you just two very basic examples. So that, and all the way up to, you know, developing a stronger investigative skills and capabilities, etc., etc. Of course, Pacific Islands and their law enforcement agencies have been recipients of foreign law enforcement assistance and training from a number of different partners. So some of that, it is already happening, this strengthening of local capacity. But the challenges are are significant, and the level of, the current level of resilience is not high enough to withstand these growing criminal trends.
And that's Virginia Kamoli, head of the Pacific Program at the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime, speaking to Liam Fox. Campaigning is intensifying as Solomon Islands heads to what's being described as the country's most important elections. But what's at stake when Solomon Islanders cast their ballots on Election Day, which is April the 17th? Joining us this morning to help answer that question is Dr. Tarsisia Skabudaulaka, who is an Associate Professor at the University of Hawaii's Centre for Pacific Island Studies. With that, I say aloha, Tarsisia.
Yeah, aloha, and thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Appreciate your company this morning. As we get into this, why do you say that this is the most important election in the country's history?
I think, you know, there are a lot of things at stake. And, you know, first and foremost is the economy of the country. Solomon Islands has been struggling economically since 2000. But during the period of Ramsey, we've seen a recovery in the economy. However, in the post-Ramsey period, what we've seen is negative growth for some years, and particularly in the past 5 years. We've seen growth in the past 2 years, but not sufficient to be able to sustain government's ability to provide services to Solomon Islanders.
But can I ask that for those past 5 years you spoke about, a lot of that would have been due to even COVID. Is that a fair assessment?
But even before COVID, so if you look at the economy, even before COVID, you see, you know, negative growth as well. In 2022, we've seen a huge negative growth, and that was attributed to COVID as well as to the Russia-Ukraine war and its impact on global economy. And that's according to the Central Bank of Solomon Islands. But that negative growth, we've seen it before COVID as well.
Professor, what then are some of the issues front of mind for Solomon Islanders going into this elections in April then?
You know, for a lot of Solomon Islanders, it's access to basic services and quality services, as well as, you know, things like health, for instance. For many years now, Solomon Islanders have been complaining about the quality of health services that you have, particularly outside of Honiara, in rural areas where where most Solomon Islanders live. And also access to education is really expensive. In for most Solomon Islanders, sending kids to school, particularly high school, is quite expensive as well. And there are other services that Solomon Islanders think that could be improved.
And interesting enough, for the first time, geopolitics is being raised as a campaign issue. Do you think voters really care that much about foreign policy?
Well, you know, traditionally, Solomon Islanders do not necessarily vote based on foreign policy. But I think it's different now. It's different because there is a lot of awareness of what's been happening since 2019. And we've seen, you know, this discussion and in 2019 and onwards, particularly with the switch to China. So there's a lot of that discussion in the media. Of course, people in rural areas, that's not the big issue. But a lot of people who dominate the media are well aware of this, and they mostly in Honiara, but quite influential as well.
And again, you've said even in a recent article that China and US have that capacity to influence domestic politics in Solomon Islands. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, in terms of influencing the kinds of discussions that are taking place during campaign period. And I'll give one example. You know, last week we see the Chinese ambassador give a talk at the Solomon Islands National University, and he's the ambassador of China. And of course, we expect the ambassador to highlight China's achievements and so forth. It's the timing of that kind of event. And we are now seeing people talk about the Chinese ambassador's talk during or in campaign discussions. And so those kinds of things, I think, will influence discussions at the local level. So what we are seeing is an example of where discussions of international relations have an impact on domestic politics in Solomon Islands.
Yeah, let's stay with China, because the influence has obviously influenced Prime Minister there, Manasseh Songovare, who recently used a speech to praise China's political system, even suggested that democracy leads to moral decay and gay marriage. What do you make of those comments?
So, you know, Songovare has been quite successful since the switch from Taiwan to China, successful in the eyes of a lot of people, in that China has contributed to the construction of things that are very visible. For instance, the National Stadium in Honiara, they're working on a new medical center also in Honiara, which is going to be huge and very visible. And for Songovare, that's political capital to show to people that, you know, the switch to China has delivered. And also recently, last week, there was the signing of agreement to build the Aoki Road by the Chinese. And also this is, you know, done during campaign session. It could have been done after or before. And because of that, it's likely to influence discussions, particularly on Malaita, where the former premier, Daniel Sri Dani, has been quite vocal against Chinese presence in Malaita. So this will likely influence that. And as I said, you know, for Songovare, it's political capital to use during campaign seasons.
Thank you for that. If you just tuned in to Pacific Beat, we're speaking to Dr. Tarsisia Skabutalaka on the upcoming elections in the Solomon Islands. You also wrote, Doctor, that because this is the first time provincial and national elections are being held at the same time, the national political issues really could maybe overshadow the provincial ones. Can you maybe elaborate on that, please?
So if you see a lot of the discussions that are taking place in the media and perhaps in villages in Solomon Islands, as well, a lot of them focus around national leaders, those vying for position in the national parliament. And therefore, it pushes out discussions about issues that are very local, at the ward level. And the other thing is a lot of people who are candidates are trying to get into the national parliament. And so it would be interesting to see the quality of leaders that we elect into the provincial assemblies after this election. And this is the first time, so it'll be the first time to see whether having these two elections together, which makes sense financially, because it means that we don't have to have another election and pay for it. But whether, you know, in the process, what we are doing is we, you know, some of the quality leaders that would have otherwise contested for provincial seats are all now doing it for parliament. And so it'll be interesting to see the quality of provincial leaders that we have after the election.
And a big question probably on many of people's minds will be, do you think, though, that Manasseh Songovare will come back as Solomon Islands' next Prime Minister?
You know, one thing I've learned over the years is that predicting Solomon Islands politics is really, really dangerous. But it will be, I think, a huge competition, not only for his political party, but for him as well. He's from Choiseul, so I do not know enough about what's going on in Choiseul to say whether he will be re-elected in his constituency or not. But I think at the national level will be quite interesting because our party, which is his party, has been, you know, quite aggressive in their campaign. They're going out throughout the country, and they have the financial resources to be able to do that in ways that other parties don't have. And so, you know, they're able to rally huge crowds of their campaign. Whether that translates to seats in parliament, we don't know.
And I do just want to get a quick response from you, Doctor. Do you think then there is a substantive rival?
So that's the big thing. I mean, from the current members of parliament, the question arises, so who is the alternative prime minister if Soghavare doesn't come in? And it's difficult to say. I mean, you have people like Peter Kenny Laurier Jr. or Matthew Wale. The question is whether they will be able to rally enough support within parliament to become prime minister. I'm not certain that that's the case. And then you have former prime minister Gordon Darcy Lilo, who is contesting the central Honiara constituency. And if he wins, you know, whether he will put his name in the pool of potential prime ministers and whether he will be able to rally support. I suspect that, you know, like in the past, we will probably see a coalition government after the election. And that's assuming that no single party wins enough seat to be able to form government. History has shown us that Solomon Islands has, you know, in many of the parliaments that we've had, build coalitions to form government. So we'll see what happens after April 17.
Absolutely. That is the date that we will be waiting for those results. And Dr. Tarsisius, we thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you for having me.
No worries. That is Dr. Tarsisius Skabundalaka, Associate Professor there at the University of Hawaii Centre for Pacific Island Studies. Up next, we've got your news wrap.
Want to catch up or listen again to your favourite ABC Radio Australia programs anytime, anywhere? From Pacific Beat to Stories from the Pacific, Nisian Footy to Culture Compass. You can listen to your top shows on your favourite podcast app on the go and for free. Just search for your favourite ABC Radio Australia program in your podcast app and press play. ABC Radio Australia, bringing you more ways to listen.
It's a Monday morning. Thank you so much for joining us here on Pacific Beat. It's time to head around the region so we know what is the latest with our news wrap brought to you by producer Mackenzie Smith. With that, I say good morning, Mackenzie.
Morning, Aggie.
Yeah, thanks for joining us this morning. Gosh, some very unfortunate things happening in PNG where a devastating earthquake has struck East Sepik province.
Yeah, so according to the US Geological Survey, a magnitude 6.9 quake just over 40 kilometres deep struck East Sepik at around 6:22 a.m. local time on Sunday. The Post Courier newspaper is reporting that hundreds of people along the Sepik River have been displaced already, while the Governor, Alan Bird, estimates 1,000 homes have been destroyed. The Post Courier also quotes a man from Sotmeri village, Ruben Kami, saying a three-year-old boy in their village died after his house collapsed on him, trapping him underwater. The Minister for Defence, Billy Joseph, says he is deploying defence assets to the area to help anyone in need.
Very unfortunate to hear, and rest in love to that young boy that has passed away. Gosh, the governor, though, of East Sepik, Alan Bird, he's released a statement on the earthquake. What has he actually said?
Well, he's been visiting the area and says preliminary damage assessments are still taking place. So the number of houses could destroyed could actually be much higher than 1,000. Alan Bird says there are several casualties already being reported to him. And he says SEPEC cannot afford to wait for government funding to assist people. So the provincial government has already authorised the use of 5.6 million kina for relief efforts. Alan Bird says this will go towards sourcing medical assistance, clean drinking water, food, shelters and materials for rebuilding those communities affected.
Thanks for sharing that story, Mackenzie. Hopefully we can get someone on to sort of elaborate and, you know, get a bit of insight into what is actually happening there on the ground. We head to the Cook Islands now, though. The former Deputy Prime Minister has received a jail term. What's happened?
Yeah, so this happened on Friday. Robert Tapaito was sentenced to 2 years and 9 months in prison for his part in corrupt practices while in office. Tapaito and his two co-accused, one a senior government official and his wife, were found guilty of taking $70,000 in public funds between April 2019 and March 2021 for personal use. That included Tapaito attending, using the funds to attend his uncle's funeral in New Zealand. Tapaito was removed from Parliament after he was convicted in February. The Cook Islands News reports his co-accused, the former director of National Environment of the National Environment Service, Ngā Tokorua Puna, received a 5-year prison sentence, while his wife Diane Charlie Puna received an 18-month sentence.
Well, a lot happening in the Pacific, some not all good news, but I do appreciate you bringing that to us this morning, Mackenzie.
Anytime.
No worries. That, of course, is our producer, Mackenzie Smith, with our news wrap here on Pacific Beat. It's known as kaiso in Japanese, nama in Fijian, limo in Tonga in Samoa. Yes, it's a type of seaweed, and it has the potential to transform the lives of women in the Pacific and bring positive change across a underdeveloped industry. I earlier spoke to project lead researcher Professor Nick Paul from the University of the Sunshine Coast on the lasting change this could bring to the region.
Seaweed is almost the unsung hero of the ocean. But of course, in the Pacific Islands, it's a very strong cultural connection, source of nutritious food, and there's so many different types out there. So basically around 15,000 varieties of seaweed, and there's a seaweed for every purpose that you could possibly imagine, whether it's food or being in dog food and pet care, and whether it's also being used to make fertilizer or biostimulants for your crops. Pretty much variety of all the products you can make is endless.
Is it seaweed farming that the project is concentrated on?
Yeah, so there's a lot of seaweed farming that happens in Asia. So Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Philippines, as well as in China and Korea. We're looking at doing with this new project in the Pacific, so in Fiji, in Samoa and Kiribati, and working directly with the ministries there that are in charge of fisheries, as well as some other colleagues in the universities there. And basically that team of people are looking at what seaweeds can be developed in each country. So in Fiji, there's some farming activity that's already happening, the same species that are grown in Indonesia. But there's also, if you go down to the markets in Suva and Nandi, you can see a whole range of different fresh seaweeds. What the Fijian work will be to support some of the farming that's happening. It's mostly by women, which is really exciting. And then also look at, can some of these other species that are just being harvested at the moment, can they actually start to be farmed so you have more control over it? And it's sort of the same principle then in Samoa and Kiribati as well, but different species.
What do the legs of this look like? You know, I mean, gosh, there must be operational costs, having to consider the environment and all of those things. Yeah, take us through that.
Yeah, look, absolutely. And people might have heard much more about seaweed in the last few years than they ever did. Farming and producing the seaweed is pretty much as environmentally sustainable as you can get. And it's potentially much better from a climate point of view, a much better source of protein and nutrients than other crops and potentially also animals too. So with that sort of context, this new funding by the International Development Research Centre from Canada, how does aquaculture fit into a sustainable sort of practice in the future?
And we talk about sustainability. You've alluded a little bit to climate change. How much more so then for it being a source of income for these women and their families?
You're exactly right. There's no point having some wonderful solution on paper if it's not going to be taken up and run with. So that's why we actually, rather than leading with the technology, so to speak, as in how do you farm things and what materials can you use, which are all, don't get me wrong, all quite important parts of developing a new industry. What we're actually doing is focusing far more on women's groups and what they perceive to be the benefits of doing the farming and making sure that they then have all the appropriate resources to be able to do it.
Is there any other type of study or projects like this to maybe garner some sort of comparison to see whether or not this actually will work?
So we're always drawing on different sort of case studies from other places, and I've been really lucky to have done quite a lot of work funded by the Australian government with ASIA in Indonesia as well as in the Pacific. So we're drawing on lots of proven examples that work, as in there's an international market for this one type of seaweed that's produced in Indonesia, but it's also the one that's starting to be farmed in Fiji and other countries. And basically, if you produce that seaweed and you produce enough of it to be able to ship in a shipping container, then you're sort of getting a guaranteed price. And that's great. You know, it's a commodity market. And so that method is really well established, and it's the method that can be followed. Can we actually start to also use that same seaweed, so the one that's been cultured? And in Fiji and places like Kiribati, it has been cultured on and off since the 80s and 90s. So we're not talking about something that's brand new here either. It just stops and starts, and that's the real challenge. Women in Seaweed in Fiji is a cooperative group that are starting to do a lot of work farming the seaweed. Can they also start to make new food products? So rather than just drying the seaweed and shipping it without doing the sort of so-called value adding, can they actually make some food that can be sold directly or sort of that shorter supply chain? As I mentioned at the beginning, it's culturally important for many countries like Samoa, and there's a general appreciation for the seaweed, but there's also a general interest in making it more sustainable and hopefully bringing even the price down for some of the wild harvest ones that aren't as easy to get anymore.
I am a big fan of seaweed, which I'm sure amongst many of our listeners who will be tuning in are fans of consuming seaweed. So, and I don't want this to be a gender-based question, but it's going to have to be. Why just for the women?
It's a really good question, right? And in the Pacific, that seaweed is pretty much normally women's business, even the gleaning and the harvesting from the reef. And of course, men. So we have to sometimes, when you describe a project, you have to sort of talk about the headline things and the main things. So of course, men are going to be involved in different parts. But the reality is that it is something that women can do pretty much on their own, which is nice when you think about it. So then whether men are involved or not in that supply chain is their decision.
When the ladies are done and dusted, can you share really the benefits of eating seaweed, what it does for one's health?
From a technical point of view, what it boils down to is that seaweeds are an amazing source of minerals. So when the seaweed is growing in the ocean, obviously growing in the salt water, they don't just take up sodium chloride, which we all hear about, like a lot about sodium when it comes to your health. They're actually exclusively taking up other minerals as well, like potassium, magnesium, iron, iodine, zinc. So all of these micronutrients that you can look up and go, oh, what's the recommended daily intake for that? Oh, I could actually only eat a few sort of sushi nori sheets or a handful of seaweed and I'll get quite a lot of my recommended daily intake. But also the fiber is that, so agar and carrageenan, when we eat those, can be soluble fiber as well as insoluble fiber. So there are also some protein, basically the amino acids, and a little bit of a very small amount of oil, but it's pretty healthy oil. You can do the calculations and see if you substitute in seaweed rather than another product, you'll get quite a boost in the potential health benefit. Everybody knows that it's healthy, but it's about getting that sustainable, regular supply too.
And that's Professor Nick Paul from the University of the Sunshine Coast and project lead researcher. And we turn to sport now, where the Fijian Drua made history at Churchill Park in Lautoka on Saturday, thanks to a stunning drop goal from Kemu Valentini in extra time. The 39-36 victory marked the first win for the Drua of the New South Wales since the Fijians joined the Super Rugby Pacific competition. Speaking to the media after the match, Fijian Drua coach Mick Burns says the score could have been higher.
I think we worked extremely hard in the first half to put ourselves in a good position. And then full credit to the Waratahs. They came back in that second half and put us under the pressure. Thought we defended well there at the line in that last sort of 10 minutes. And then we went to Golden Point and we found a way to win. So, I just said to the boys, we find new ways to win games of rugby. But you only do it if you dig deep. Waratahs dug deep today and came back well in the second half, but we were good enough to step across the line at the end. And it's disappointing when you look at the scoreboard, but, full credit to the Waratahs. They came back and I thought their bench was really good when they came on. I thought their bench carried hard and asked lots of questions of us. And we got ourselves in a bit of trouble. But it's just the game. And as I said, we let a few points in there, but When you needed to step up in that Golden Point time and we were down in front of our line and we kept getting off the line and coming forward, that's now 90 minutes of football our boys are playing, So our men now know that they've got it in the tank and they're just going to go hard.
And the Drua coach took a cheeky poke at the Waratahs by wearing a Chicago Bulls baseball cap at the press conference.
We may not have played like the Chicago Bulls and we may not have won like the Chicago Bulls, but we won, and that's the most important thing.
Bit of a cheeky reference by Mick Burns to a newspaper report 2 years ago, where the New South Wales coach described their win over the Drua as beating a team that wasn't quite the Chicago Bulls. While the Fijian Drua were very happy with their win, unfortunately their women's team couldn't quite do the same. The Super Dub champs down 62-21 against the Waratahs.
Join me, Melissa Macon, for Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference. Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday from 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Let's take a look at one of our main stories today. The United Nations International Seabed Authority prepares to begin its second week of meetings in Jamaica. A Hawaiian elder, Pili Kaho'ohalahala, is appealing to those Pacific nations to support deep sea mining to reconsider.
I would call upon countries like Nauru, the Cook Islands, and Tonga to be reminded that their decisions are going to have an impact on all of us.
Up next, it is your news on ABC Radio Australia, and coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily. Appreciate your company this morning. Until next time, I'm Aggie Dubow, and this is Pacific Beat.